testament to Harrow's timing for drama, the Secundarius bell began ringing. From above the drill shaft, the shuttle started to make its descent, blotting out the ever fainter light of the equinox. For the very first time, Gideon did not feel the overwhelming sense of dread and suspicion. A pinprick of anticipation curled in her gut instead. Round two. Go.
You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, Episode 6, A Bad Cavalier.
So we have this first part of the chapter is a training montage, but it's not like a Rocky training montage where there's like this really like compelling motivation. You're rooting for the character. You're kind of, I imagine you're just kind of just seeing like Egg Lemonade just groan and be frustrated and roll her eyes. And
it feels like a slog rather than a triumph.
Yeah. Yeah. My brain is trying to find the right song for this training montage, and that might take a while because like training montages and slogs are not like, when I hear a song, I don't normally think, wow, this sounds like training in a way that drives me crazy and is exhausting and frustrating.
Might I recommend Training Montage by the Mountain Goats?
Love the Mountain Goats.
I do too. They're very Locktomb coded.
Hashtag no children. I really hope someone out there has done some type of like fan video edit to No Children because...
Sweetie, I have.
Oh, that's why. Oh, okay. So I was like, this feels familiar.
Yeah, I did chapter 4 and 5, this exact scene to No Children.
That tracks.
So the secret thing down at the bowels of Dreerbird, what do you think Crux is up to?
Well, I do imagine locking Harrow's parents in the tomb is probably a component of that.
Yeah.
But I imagine something to do with the tomb is Harrow wants to be prepared to know that that's secure, but also that she can strategically leverage her control over what is going on with the tomb while she's away. It's a combination of maintaining that responsibility, lowering liabilities such as her parent puppets. I don't know. It's definitely like I can feel Gideon's like, what is she up to down there? What is she up to down there? What is she doing? No. Do you have any of these suspicions?
I didn't even think of it was putting the parents away. I was totally reading this like, what is he doing? And of course it's that. Yeah, no, it must be that because that's located correctly. And then we get the reveal about the parents being locked away at the end of this chapter.
If Harrow's parents are not being actively puppeted and maintained by Harrow because she is going off world, will they begin to decay?
Ooh, a grisly question.
Can that responsibility of maintaining that be passed off to another necromancer? Is there another necromancer who is aware of that on the night?
It seems like no, based on what Gideon understands of the situation, although obviously Gideon doesn't know everything. Yeah, if so, Harrow is really kind of saying goodbye to her parents in a way.
Like that, yeah, yeah. I'm curious how, like, there's got to be an emotional element to that to her, despite the fact that, like, she has already had to say goodbye to her parents in certain ways. She's also, this is a new kind of goodbye in a way that's much more permanent, obviously. And, you know, we know that Harrow's unaware of maybe the expectation that the Lictors will not return to their home planets.
Yeah.
If she's not aware of that, then perhaps this, like, interring of her parents is her just being like, well, their expiration date passed a while ago and I can't keep the fridge going.
I think she definitely does not know. I think she thinks she's coming back and she's coming back in Lictoral power and influence.
Yeah. But she doesn't know how long she'll be away. Mm-hmm. And she really doesn't. I'm sure she can understand how decay might work when someone's form is released someone's meaty form rather than bony form, when someone's meaty form is released from necromantic control, she probably has an understanding of the rate of decay that would normally occur. But it would be interesting wondering if, you know, someone's been puppeted for 7 years in a necromantically maintained body, is their decay going to look different than if it was just a normal pacing?
Yeah. Harrow understands the lictoral process as a competition.
To me, this reflects her understanding of the relationship between the houses.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea that the Ninth is fighting to survive, it's under-resourced and under-supported by the Empire. That would definitely fuel a sense of competition. She's like, I need to beat everyone so that we survive. If I lose, if I am like still the lowest ranked house, this isn't going to get better.
Mm-hmm.
She has to be the best, or else the Knights will not get the new renewed support that she's expecting to get out of Lictorhood. You know, and it talks a little bit about this moment of how worried she is about that. Like, this is a genuine apprehension where she's like, no, this is the real deal. I have to win this.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when Harrow feels like her back's up against the wall, which I imagine she has for some time now, this is just a very real expression of it. And it being possible that the other houses will see just how much her back is up against the wall. She has to show that that's not a limiting factor for her or for the Ninth.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think, you know, we talk about the Third immediately following, and I'm like, I bet the Third also think about it as a competition.
Was it the Third house that she was really worried about was going to take over in the last chapter? Because, in the last chapter, she said, we're not becoming an appendix of the Third or the Fifth houses. And she also said that the Third was like the best equipped. Like, she's very anxious about the Third.
She's very anxious about the Third, and her way of responding to that is to try and have as much information as possible.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it turns out she's completely correct to worry about the Third.
And worrying people who, like, try and collect as much information as possible, analyze things to a great extent. This is the way that some fears arise and express themselves. Worrying anxious people, like, in survival situations, while they are not creative in their thinking, they're often more willing to acknowledge the risks and the threats than someone who is not afraid.
Mm-hmm.
If someone's like, you know, it's fine, I don't have to worry, stress about this, is kind of a buffering between you and the actual threats. Harrow sees this one way because she is in that mode. But it's honestly, in my opinion, a perfectly reasonable response given the conditions that she's in. Again, it's limiting because she's only seeing it one way, but she's doing everything in her power to be equipped for this. I love that this chapter has more sword talk.
And it does have more sword talk.
It's more sword talk.
What is Iglamine's deal with blocking?
I think the main thing is that when you are blocking with one hand, it's parrying is more of a redirect of the force. With a long sword, like, yes, you can parry, but Gideon's temperament is the kind where she's just going to lock straight on and then push forward. Like, the mechanics of how you redirect force are both stylistic, but also, like, with a smaller blade, with a single hand, you are not braced as well to block, and parrying is mechanically more efficient.
Mm.
And as someone who relates to Gideon's temperament as a fighter, rapier also feels very like, okay, go this way. Like, it's a bit more, not passive, the kind of patience that parrying embodies. Like, it's like, okay, I'm going to move this aside. I'm going to move this aside. I'm going to wait until the right opportunity. While I could see Gideon just trying to, like, direct block in a really rigid way. Yeah, it is not mechanically efficient to try and directly block with a rapier in a way that you can get away with a longsword, because you're braced with your entire body.
Fighting Case, blocking was a really important skill for me. And I was often getting advice to block more and better. And so seeing Iglamine be like, stop blocking all the time, I'm like, that's not how it goes.
For our audience, Case is a double rapier style of fighting. So in this, you again have the entirety of your body to do this with. Usually one of your swords is leading your block and the second one is supporting it.
Yeah.
So mechanically, you still get to have both sides of your body as participants in the block.
And of course, if your opponent only has one sword, you can block and let your one sword be totally tangled up and still stab them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it is a thing that's hard to avoid when you're fighting Case, that one of your swords gets tangled up.
Yeah, that's just part of the plan.
You're like, I've got an extra one. Ha ha. It talks about the footwork rapier versus longsword. And I would love to talk a little bit more about that, because the way that it describes the footwork of rapier is only stepping forward with one foot. And so often rapier is fought in a line. Mm-hmm. You are stepping forward, you are stepping back. Your sword moves directly out in front of your body rather than something like a saber, which maybe is moving at 45 degrees. Like, all of these require different footwork to make the most of the arm mechanics and the wrist mechanics. But when you are fighting with something that only moves in a line, it implies a certain type of relationship to your opponent, which is that they are right in front of you and are going to stay right in front of you. The easiest way to illustrate this is looking at Olympic fencing. They have like a 3 or 3.5 foot wide strip that is many, many more feet long. And that's their whole range of motion. Long swords involve much wider sweeping or motions, and your feet follow and lead with that as well.
One of the things that this tells us culturally is that the cavalier style of fencing is seemingly derived from Olympic fencing rather than from medieval fencing.
Yeah, and because medieval fencing has multiple different traditions, like you can find different manuals and sword masters from across Europe who do look at other forms of footwork. There is a guy, Destreza, is a Spanish sword master, and he had a like somewhere between a clock and a sun of a circle, and you step in these triangles through this circle. It is not a linear way of moving. There are different styles and traditions. And so while your sword thrusting straight out from in front of you is true, it takes more advantage of the fact that the shoulder can be pointing in a lot of different directions. So yeah, this style has been derived from predecessors that used a very straight-on style of confrontation, which, you know, Gideon hates, mm-hmm. does not like this. And they're like, let's hope no one looks at you too closely. Ha ha! We're alluding to future things again, because this is, I believe, exactly how Ianthe figures out that Gideon's a fraud. If I remember correctly.
Dulcinea.
Oh, that's how Dulcinea figures out that Gideon's a fraud, by watching the mismatch between her body's movement and the sword that she's using.
Yeah.
Which is interesting that it's Dulcinea rather than Nibirius.
I think Nibirius also refers to Gideon as like a thug or a street fighter or something. Like, other people also clock that she's not just a rag cav.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the biggest tell, because no matter how silent Gideon is, her body still speaks for her pretty clearly.
We get a couple more clues about clothing and status in this chapter. Gideon receives hand-me-downs that are remade from Ordis's clothing, which is a common practice that has fallen out of practice in my culture in the last 100 years, but used to be very, very typical. Fabric is expensive to make, and so once fabric exists, it is remade and remade, particularly, as in this case, from a larger to a smaller size.
Yeah.
And we get the clues that the clothing is basically the same style as what she's used to, but it's better made and blacker. So her clothing is probably older. It's more faded it has lost some of its black dye, and Ortis's clothing is maybe a little bit newer, a little bit literally better made. And it also gives the clue later on that her secondhand clothes are itchy. So she has maybe moved from synthetics into wool.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the feeling of wool on my skin. I want to have a chat with Aglemine about wool because I feel like Aglemine might also enjoy wool. But going from extremely smooth synthetics to something with actual texture is a strange experience. For I think anyone moving between different types of fibers, like you go from being acclimated to that sensory experience to having something totally different on your skin. And it's disruptive and distracting and irritating. And I think it's a distracting even if you're moving up in quality because it's just so different.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, we know that Gideon has sensitive skin and some people cannot tolerate wool straight on their skin because of some of the chemicals that it might be treated with or the dyes themselves. Like there's lots of things that can be. When I was in a youth military training program in the U.S., and had to wear a second pair of pants under my military trousers, no matter how hot it was, because the particular wool blend that they used was just not tolerable for my skin.
Yeah, my research into military wool blends, since I want to say World War II, they've been blending in additional fibers for longevity, and longevity being the priority, not comfort. And that would make sense for it to continue to be true for someone who fulfills like a military role in a household. I want to once again apologize to my dear precious baby Ortis for not recognizing how shitty Muir was to him earlier in the book. And yet again, makes him the butt of a joke. I love my poetry boy. And she yet again takes pains to highlight how exceptional in a negative way Ortis's body is, which like, no, we love our boy. He's never done anything wrong.
We were discussing in the chapter where they were ransacking swords in the crypt that they weren't going for Ortis's grandmother's sword, but something like Ortis's grandmother's sword. And here we find out that Aglamine settles on Ortis's grandmother's mother's sword, which apparently is far enough not to offend their sensibilities.
I wonder, is it the one on the cover of the book? It is described as far simpler. And when you look at the cover of the book, it is not a full swept basket hilt guard that Gideon is carrying. It looks almost like a quarter to a third of a basket. And so that being the way that simplification is, that being the way that simpler looks, tracks. So maybe that's the one we're seeing on the cover.
I absolutely adore the description that Gideon gives of her dream sword, where she says, I wanted one with a skull puking another smaller skull and other skulls flying all around, but tasteful.
I immediately wanted to look at the rest of the book covers. I wanted to relook. I haven't not yet, but I wanted to also relook at this book cover because that feels like, again, one of those very specific descriptions. And I'm like, don't get me wrong. I see the vision, Gideon. I see the vision. But also, is this mirror leaving us another little trail of breadcrumbs?
I want to make this sword.
Of the sword, the skull tastefully puking a smaller skull?
I think that would be a great, like, convention piece.
Totally. Yeah. It's one of those gifts for a very specific range of people who will appreciate it for what it truly is. Which I think, at least in my experience as a creator within this fandom, making extremely niche art to give your friends feelings is the thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's fine if only one person ever realizes what it is. Worth it. Absolutely worth it. I remember making TikToks specifically to hurt specific friends' feelings.
Yeah.
And being like, I made you this. And they're like, I hate you. And I'm like, I love you too. I like hurting people's feelings, but like, as you described in your blog post, you are insane. you take this and elevate it to levels of thought and production that are beyond my skill set. And it's just like, I sometimes wonder if I'm seeing the full vision, but I'm like, I know I'm crying about it. My heart feels it.
We see what passes for praise between Gideon and Iglamine. Iglamine says that after 11 ghoulish weeks of training you, beating you senseless, and watching you fall around like a dropsical infant, which, interesting medical culture moment there, you are on a miraculous day up to the standard of a bad cavalier, one who's terrible. And Gideon informs us this is great praise.
Iglamine's estimate that it would take 6 years, this fits into that, where Iglamine was like, this is hopeless, from the framing of having to train Gideon with the rapier in 3 months. She's like, I guess you're trained, but indisputably to Iglamine, Gideon is a cavalier.
I think there's such an interesting contrast between Iglamine's sense that Gideon may be one of the best cavaliers that the house has ever produced, which she, of course, does not say to Gideon, but says to Harrow in Gideon's hearing. And the fact that Iglamine can so routinely defeat her in training, which I felt for me brought up that sense of, like, when you're in training, it's really hard to know how good you are because the person who trains you knows everything about you. Your trainer and the people that you train closely with are never exactly a fair fight because they know you so intimately. They know every habit, every flaw, every project, everything you're working on, everything you've ever done wrong in the last however many years. And Iglamine isn't necessarily beating her because Iglamine is a better fighter. Iglamine could be beating her because she's her teacher.
Yeah. When I have trained regularly with the same group of people, I always get taken out by the same shot. I remember when I first started training, it was my offhand leg because my shield was just a little bit too high.
Yeah.
I remember when I was training rapier, it was my head because I lean forward. There's these tendencies. And there's also this thing that happens with your trainers and with the people that you train with is that you evolve in response to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Iglamine not just knows everything that Gideon's doing and is about to do, but Iglamine has trained for years to handle Gideon as an opponent. There is literally no one who is more specialized and equipped to beat Gideon in a fight than Iglamine.
And Crux, who has also been kicking Gideon's ass the whole time.
That's and Crux. And when you're older as a fighter, you start to become more efficient. You have gained a lot of data about how people fight, and you've gained a decision-making pattern, which it identifies in this. You can't, like, people can learn to fight, but learning to think is another thing entirely. And that is one of the ways in which Gideon is criticized in this chapter. They're like, okay, we need to get you up to speed and also thinking. But Iglamine's decision-making around confrontation and combat is not just informed by, you know, training, but combat experience. Iglamine's seen a lot more than Gideon has and will for some time.
Yeah, and I think that lack of experience is something that makes it hard to know how good Gideon really is, because part of what makes you good at sword fighting, what it means to be good at sword fighting, is being able to meet a wide variety of opponents. Yeah. And Gideon has trained with Iglamine, and maybe Gideon also trained with Ordis some. That seems likely, but it's not clear how many people were part of that training community and how many people Gideon has actually encountered. And we know that, you know, there aren't people coming in from outside the house anymore in the last 5 years. And so Gideon isn't getting a wide range of opponents to experience and learn from and interpret and build that decision-making skill.
Yeah. When I was fighting rapier, I went to New York for a tournament on the other side of the continent from where I've trained. And it also is the case that I didn't train with people outside of my school in my city. And that has to do with very, very almost stereotypical sword social conflict. But it meant that I had a very small group of people that I was used to fighting. And I didn't think very well of my rapier fighting. I've never loved rapier. I'm much more brawly. It's another reason why I love Gideon. I'm like, I'm sure we'd have a great fight.
But Gideon wrestling.
Just me and Gideon wrestling. I meddled in that tournament. I came in second. Mm. I definitely could say that I had a shot at first. It stunned me how skilled I was. And that had to do with the way that I was trained. And so I developed a real appreciation for that. But the degree to which I did not have a perspective of my own fighting. And I honestly still don't, because I never really got out and widely trained with a larger community. Because what happens is that pockets of people that train with each other develop their own idiosyncrasies based on those training relationships. And those become normal within the
It's like a dialect.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's fun because you can kind of use it forensically sometimes too. There's a particular hand flourish, a kind of like self-regulating, soothing wrist flourish that me and there's this woman, Brittany St. Leafy, who is a teacher out of, I believe, Arizona is where her school, her home school is based. I think they have other ones as well. But Brittany trained, the person who trained Brittany trained with my sword grandpa, where this flourish comes from. And so many people within my school, many people within the school that Brittany trained in and within Mord Howe, which is Brittany's school, would display this flourish. Like you can actually use this to say, okay, these tendencies and these mechanisms are related to each other. And it would be fun to think about that. Like what are the unique styles of the third? What are the unique styles of, I believe, the sixth? Because their priorities and who they're training with would be different. When you have a military training, you are often having drilling prior to sparring, and drilling is a much bigger component because you can train a larger number of people through drilling than through coached sparring, which requires a much more one-to-one kind of relationship.
When Aglamine refers to Gideon as a dropsical infant, this gives us a little bit of insight into ninth or perhaps imperial medical culture. Dropsy is an outdated term that refers to edema, which is a buildup of fluid in between, in what's called the interstitium, which is like the space between cells. And a lot of different things can cause it. And part of why we don't talk about dropsy anymore is that it is increasingly talked about in terms of the various causes. But the idea that edema is kind of routinely affecting infants and that this is sort of a disabling condition for infants tells us something about the medical conditions of, you know, reproductive health on the ninth.
Are you familiar enough with those different causes that you might speculate what of that is relevant?
Well, malnutrition can be a factor. So that could be something. It could be something that disproportionately impacts necromantic babies because of the kind of link between necromancy as sort of a wasting condition as we see it. It can also be related to things like heart failure, kidney disease, liver disease. So there's a lot of different kind of organ issues that can lead to edema. In infants, it is often caused by genetic disorders or infections.
Interesting.
And it can be life-threatening. It can be an immune thing having to do with Rh compatibility, and it can come from genetic issues. So it's interesting that is kind of an easy to hand metaphor for Aglamine on the ninth, where there has been this fertility crisis, and it's possible that the fertility crisis is not just inability to conceive, but that a high infant mortality was part of the cause for the ninth's population problem. I think it gets treated largely surgically, but blood transfusions can also be part of it. So like the way that this gets treated today has to do with like fluid removal and breathing supports and blood transfusions and then, you know, treating whatever the underlying cause is. And so there are fairly technological interventions, and it's possible that the Ninth doesn't have NICU technology.
Yeah, and we've talked before about the high-tech versus low-tech elements that we're seeing on the Ninth. I don't know, the health of the Ninth does not seem to be prioritized.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes me like think about what is happening at the systemic level, that is true, that is perpetuated, because the Empire relies on the secrets that the Ninth keeps being kept secret.
But everybody on the Ninth dying would be a great way to keep a secret.
True. And that would be quite easy to spin one direction or another. And no one seems to really care about the Ninth anyway, except as a, like, what are they hiding kind of thing. When I was thinking about chapter readings for the beginning of this episode, The one of Gideon fantasizing about the Ninth collapsing as soon as she stops being there.
Yeah.
Is one that really stood out to me. It also feels ominously prophetic.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, Hera also knows how fragile the Ninth will be once they leave.
I thought that this passage really highlighted how young Gideon is and the way that teenagers really view themselves as the protagonist. Like, Gideon is literally the protagonist, but this way of thinking about the world is so being a 17-year-old that this idea that when she leaves, this entire scene will just stop existing. And maybe it only exists because of her.
And I imagine that being one of three children doesn't do anything to counter that very much. I think the teenagers seeing themselves as the protagonist in their own lives is also a very like individualistic cultural thing. I imagine that teenagers that grow up in really intergenerational households, teenagers that grow up in immigrant households, are probably actually going to feel a bit deprioritized. Mm. So seeing how the different youths have related to their households is something that's interesting as we get further down into the book. Like, Gideon would never consider Ordis as a protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
Our poor boy is never given that status. And of course, a protagonist needs an antagonist, which we have this role clearly filled. Like, there's no reason why Gideon wouldn't see herself as the protagonist of the Ninth.
I love the writing of this passage. It's really, really beautiful and evocative. The line, "It continued because you watched it continue, changeless and black before your eyes," is, there's something about that feels true. Like, I don't know what place I would say that about, but there's something about it that just rings really true.
It's also interesting that, like, this isn't about Gideon getting to watch it crumble.
Mm-mm.
It's that it requires the perception for it to continue. Gideon isn't fantasizing about its destruction. Gideon's fantasizing about its frailty.
Mm-hmm.
Which is discreetly different.
Yeah, it almost kind of highlights Gideon's awareness that the Ninth is an illusion, that there's sort of nothing real about it, nothing solid.
Yeah, there isn't something to really dramatically fall apart. It just kind of vanishes. And then Gideon cries about it. Which, like, this chapter is very much an emotional rebirth for Gideon. After the devastating heartbreak of her thwarted escape attempt in previous chapter, there's hope, there's anticipation, there's fantasy, there's redemption. There's all of these little seeds of emotions that Gideon has never really felt like she's had a grip on.
Mm-hmm.
It's heartwarming, and it's also clearly so bitter.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting, as you point out, that she has this fantasy about the fragility of the house and starts crying and then finds it positive. It starts as sort of a fearful experience and then transforms into a gratifying, maybe cathartic moment of, hey, this place has sucked for me.
Yeah. And I think that the cherry on top of that catharsis is Aglemini rolling her eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Often, so I've worked as a coach in different contexts over time. And when someone is kind of in the slog of something, often you can tell that they are past the core point of that. And it's starting to shift when humor comes back into the mix.
Mm-hmm.
There will be this like turmoil, tears. And then suddenly there's a shift and then there's lightness again. And often a joke will be made. So, you know, as Gideon salutes, and I'm imagining this like as crisply and enthusiastically as a soldier on her first day of service, like Gideon's really hamming it up.
And from Aglamini's perspective, what a tableau, because Gideon has tear-streaked paint running down her face and then is like, I'm being silly and goofy.
A beautiful, beautiful moment. The kind of unself-conscious hope and glee that moment has for Gideon, where anything is possible. And she can be like, well, I'm going to salute you, but I'm also going to give you the finger at the same time. Like... Okay. It's a great energy.
I love the telegraphing in this paragraph where she imagines Crux exploding like a garbage bag full of soup.
Soup, you say?
A person exploding full of soup? What a theme.
What a funny visual.
Do you want to talk about the knuckle knives more? Because we get some...
I do want to talk about the knuckle knives. So she was also given knuckles. They were less ornate, being obsidian and steel set in thick and heavy bands. So I have tried to make a few different prototypes of knuckle knives, and we've talked about them in earlier episodes, compare them to kind of, you know, your Wolverine knuckles. Knuckle knives are great for brawlers. They take the thing that you naturally want to do with your offhand, which is get it involved, and protects it and weaponizes it. Now, there are cool things you can do with an empty offhand with a rapier. It doesn't have to be passive dead weight.
You can grab it.
You can grab things. Sort like blade grabs are really quite a lot more viable than one would imagine. They're just, to do it safely, you have to be quite precise about the way that you're doing it. It involves a twisting mechanic to lock the blade into your hand so it doesn't draw through.
And when you say draw through, what you're referring to is the blade cutting your hand, right? That's the concern?
Yeah. So if you grab someone's sword, they're going to want to pull it back.
Mm-hmm.
So the twisting motion of the wrist applies pressure in another direction that makes it more difficult to draw it back. And this is even more effective when you're wearing protective, because you can still do this with protective gloves on. I had a fantastic workshop that I did with a fighter named Beth Hammer, which is just a great name for a fighter. Mudskipper Rodeo is her art blog on Instagram, but she also is a Uhurt fighter.
Nice.
I like to think of myself as a orc-sized hobbit, and I think of Beth as a hobbit-sized orc.
Nice.
Some of my favorite fights. Broke a pair of glasses in a fight with her once. But there was a workshop where Beth and teaching partner were showing blade grabs, and the twist is really key, because what you are doing is adding sideways pressure in a way that makes it much more difficult to draw through. I'm curious whether the knuckle knives were only ever intended to be an offhand, or if like paired knuckle knives is its own style, which sounds brawly and gruesome.
Yeah.
And I can imagine Gideon being so down.
Yeah.
Because that would be a nasty fight. It's also interesting because it, you know, Aglemini says, for God's sake, don't use them for anything but a parry.
Yeah. So this goes exactly against what you were describing when knuckle knives were first introduced, where you were saying that the value of a knuckle knife would be to do that flesh level damage, that raking kind of attack.
Yeah. And I think Aglemini knows that it's so effective at that kind of thing, but also knows that attacking someone from another house under these conditions in that way is not the role that Gideon needs to play.
So this is not a technique issue. This is a political strategy.
I think this is about the impact of a fighting style on a social relationship. Different fighting styles over time have related to social norms and fashions. And part of that is hierarchy and relationships. There are certain things that you don't do or are expected to not do to someone who you're supposed to give deference to. So the way that we look at slapping now as a feminized form of violence, punching has also been seen as stigmatized and unrespectable in different eras and different areas. And knowing rules is how you know how to break them, but Gideon doesn't have time to learn the rules. Mm-hmm. So Aglemine is giving Gideon one very critical rule, which is only parry with this.
Mm-hmm.
Because the damage it can do is so fast and so deep and hard to repair. Though, mind you, I imagine with necromancers of that level of skill, it wouldn't be as much of an issue. But
right. But if we imagine like her first fight with Nibirius, if she had just raked his face, that would be a big move.
Big move. And as much as I can imagine, there are, including myself, people out there who would love for Nibirius to get his shit wrecked in a real big way. It definitely, him living till the end of the book had its, you know, value. But Gideon's tendencies as a fighter are brawly.
Mm-hmm.
Gideon's instincts as a fighter are to close. Gideon is this thug, you know, and this is the language that Nibirius uses to describe her after their fight. And even prior, like he's like sniffing Gideon out as a fighter and is like, you're not refined. You're not
mm-hmm.
precise. But the thing is, rapier fighters that are refined and precise are generally much better at distance. And Aglemine knows that Gideon's tendency to close combined with knuckle knives is putting a certain amount of risk into the scenario. And part of that risk is them being outed for the situation that they're coming from.
Yeah.
Because if Gideon were to rake Nibirius's face, there would be more questions. I keep on thinking about how, and I think about this a lot at work and stuff that I've been recording outside of this podcast, about how children are siloed from the rest of society. And that creates a real disconnect to their experience in people who are no longer children.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to also hold true here. The creche was the place the children were, but none of these other spaces really seem to be designed to accommodate children. And they seem quite the traditions that and the norms, like let's say at church.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a space where kids were welcome, I think, ever. Hera would have been expected to go there. And children that are taught to be in those roles are coached for those expectations quite young, but that's not done at a group level, really.
What do you mean?
The behaviors expected from children to be in those spaces. The word disruptive comes to mind is that children explore and interact with their spaces really actively, and for kids to recognize where they must not do that. That learning has to start really early and has to be established as something they are observing in the adults around them.
Okay, so you're not suggesting that children weren't incorporated into the religious services, but just that they were like very tamped down in how they were expected to behave there.
If they were incorporated, they would have been expected to be very tamped down. Yeah. How were children taught the traditions of church in the ninth back in the day?
It seems like we see from Gideon's childhood that children were incorporated very early because she was in nun training until she was 10.
So there is formalized education and coaching to get kids familiar with what their relationship with that should be.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me think of, like, I've seen, you know, videos of these young, like, five-year-olds who are trained in, I think it's, like, the Shaolin tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And there are these incredibly masked, focused, small children that I imagine grew up in these environments. They are seeing the adults behave in a certain very high control way, very tradition, very, there is a place where you are silent. I think of these kids and I imagine the point at which their impulses as children are starting to be suppressed or redirected. I don't know what the teaching culture in those kinds of spaces is, but I find it fascinating. I want to understand it more, not necessarily because I want to reproduce it, but it's so exceptional to how I see children operate in the world elsewhere. Is it just their observation of their environment and the exceptional behaviors of the adults in their environment that is leading to this very like precise, focused, like these children do not express themselves in the way that I normally see children expressing themselves.
I wonder, I'm thinking about media framing, and it seems like the way that framing would happen would draw attention to sort of the cultural differences rather than the similarities. And yes. I wonder, you know, what does the rest of that child's day look like?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This is a very small picture of their day. And the idea that this is expected of them for a very small window is more believable than the idea, I think, that it is expected of them throughout their entire day to day.
And I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the thing that maybe I should look into is, you know, children that are raised in monastic environments, what does that look like? Because that is, you know, what Gideon experienced. She had nun training very early on, and little girls being trained in nun traditions is not without precedent. But as identified for Gideon, it's not for everybody. Some kids are not going to integrate with that training, with those expectations. It makes me think of my own self, which got my family kicked out of a church because I was too disruptive. Some kids can integrate with those expectations and other kids can't. And I think Gideon's accomplishment in terms of them being like, okay, we'll train you as a sword fighter. And she's like, now this is real. Like, I don't have to wear nun robes. I don't have to be a part of this story anymore. I'm going to be a hero. I'm going to get the fuck out of here. I think part of that is Gideon has never really meshed with the ninth. Gideon has permission to not attend church for the most part.
This chapter does conflict with that a little bit because she says that the training gets her out of going to prayer.
But the expectation of her going to prayer may be new now that she has this cavalier status.
Oh, that's true.
And prior to that, it would not have, because like the cavalier going to prayer totally makes sense.
Early in this chapter, there's some ambiguous evidence regarding the multi-death theory. Gideon doesn't put paint on one day, and Crux turns off the heating to her cell, and she ends up slumped on her tears, screaming with cold, numb, and nearly dead.
So this is our, since the beginning of the book, third did she maybe die reference?
I think third, but one of them was sort of a montage moment that could have had multiples in it.
Yeah, and if Gideon is at the point of that kind of pain with the cold, we're going to start seeing, not long after, tissue damage and tissue death, which is not mentioned.
Mm-hmm. She is fine after that.
She is fine after that. So it could be extrapolated that, like, yes, the multi-death thing is real, but also what would be permanent cellular damage for a person like me? You know, she's not losing toes and fingers. She's just in excruciating pain.
Mm-hmm.
I have a condition called Raynaud's syndrome, which basically as soon as my toes and hands are cold, I am in excruciating pain. So it's part where I'm like, maybe she just has Raynaud's. But your explanation is much more interesting, especially given the storyline.
And it's not a case where it says she died, but it's treated as metaphorical. It only says nearly died, which is why I present it as ambiguous evidence. But for sure, yeah, I think somebody who is experiencing screaming in pain from cold, we would expect to have a recovery process, which we don't see.
And not just like we don't see, we get the impression that she goes right back to training the next day.
Yeah.
Like it does not slow her down a moment.
Yeah. And that previous, we've seen that her cell, the heating got turned off in her cell previously as punishment. And this is kind of a routine part of her life.
Mm-hmm. And at no point is it ever mentioned that she suffers any long or even midterm impact from it, besides just pain and misery. I wonder how much Harrow understands about how exceptional that is. This is another one of those moments where it changes the interpretation depending on what one believes about that. Like Harrow noticing that something is very different about Gideon's body, and which would, to me, also express itself as a deviation in terms of what people's bodies look like thanergically and thallergically. Mm-hmm. Gideon's body would give off different vibes. And Harrow would be, I imagine, quite sensitive to that. Like, how much Harrow understands and believes about that, I don't know. But the idea that she is completely oblivious to it isn't believable to me. Just because of the weird thanergy-thallergy vibes that Gideon's body would be giving off basically the whole time that they're growing up together while she's being abused this way.
Mm-hmm. And neither of them have a lot to compare it to. And so how much do they notice it?
Rather than it just being, oh, that's what Gideon's like.
Yeah. Or, you know, there aren't other teenagers going through this same thing and facing death or disabling injury. And so they're not seeing that difference because everybody else is really frail and old. And Gideon is young and vigorous. And so how much does it look like it's just that?
Yeah, yeah. It makes me wonder what kind of things Harrow studies. Because like Mercy Morn studied a lot of medical knowledge. And I think Mercy Morn would know the difference through the knowledge that she acquired. But if Harrow's specifically thinking about necromancy and the treatment of the dead body, there may be a gap in her knowledge around what a body is doing in adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really relevant to Harrow's ambitions to understand what's going on in a body for a teenager.
I have to imagine that a house that lives in an extreme cold environment has fairly robust cultural knowledge of health effects of cold, because that would be something that they would need to manage. Like, no matter what kind of scientist you are, if you're stationed in Antarctica, you know about cold.
Yeah. I imagine, seeing that it's Crux who is often turning the heat off in Gideon's cell, and Crux's wish that Gideon was dead so that she would be easier to deal with, Crux using that knowledge to be like, maybe it's an oopsie, and being willfully neglectful in terms of just how much he's punishing her by turning the temperature off. Turning the heat off. Crux must understand that if this is the case, if Gideon has died or nearly died from cold once or more, Crux would have to be pretty oblivious to not see something being unusual there.
Well, and I think there has to be some level of knowledge because of the way that Crux treats her. Like, he is kicking her in the head. He is dragging her down multiple staircases of stone staircases, letting her head hit. That is the kind of thing you would do to somebody that you don't care if they live or die.
As gruesome and grisly as it is, I can also imagine Crux escalating, being like, oh, this thing that I thought would hurt you in this way isn't hurting you in the way that I thought it will. I will continue escalating my treatment of you.
That's exactly what I imagine. I imagine that he started off on a level of child abuse that was culturally normative, and because nothing happened, it stepped up, and now he's just like casually murdering her on a Tuesday because she pissed him off.
Yeah, That tracks. And, you know, what reason would he have to, you know, tell Harrow about that specifically? Mm-hmm. Like, he's doing his job. Why does she need to know about the details of it in that way?
I think this also gives us a lot of insight into indentured servitude / slavery within this world.
Yeah.
That probably there are other indentured servants on the Ninth who are also getting physically abused.
Yeah. And it often falls to Crux to do that. And it seems like he gets a degree of pleasure out of it.
It does. Also, the disciplinary implications of the fact that this house has centrally controlled individual temperature management. It's weird that there's a mechanism to turn the heat off in only her cell.
I am wondering where else in our world has those kinds of things. And the two things that jump to mind are hospitals and prisons. But I don't, those are absolutely speculation.
My understanding is that hospitals and prisons are usually temperature controlled on a floor level in the same way that, you know, an office building typically is controlled on a more general level for economic reasons, because it's not economical to control things at the individual room level like you would have in a hotel.
Yeah.
So it seems like the sort of least gross explanation for this mechanism is that they want to save heating by not heating cells that are disused. And so maybe there's a central mechanism for cell level shutoffs so that when cells are empty, when they're not being inhabited, they can be allowed to be cold.
Fun bit of etymology fact. We call cells in living organisms cells due to monastic cells. There was a monk who was studying plants and observed the little cells within them. And that is why we use that word.
Oh, it's Robert Hooke.
Robert Hooke.
1665, in his book Micrographia. Prison cells also refer to monastic cells because the concept of the modern prison is modeled on the idea of the penitentiary, the monastic penitence idea. And so on a theoretical level, a prison is supposed to be a place of soulful contemplation of wrongdoing and reclaiming of moral status. And that is also why a prison cell is called a cell.
And for a place that used to have a lot of pilgrims coming through, having individually atmospherically controlled residential cells and a lot of those being out of use now makes sense. There's going to be a lot of empty space
mm-hmm.
now that pilgrims are not coming through.
Yeah. It's not stated directly, but the process that Harrow's parents are undergoing seems to be becoming anchorites. And in the dramatis personae, the Ninth is called the Anchorite's House. And this is a form of sort of extreme monastic life in which a particular penitent is sometimes literally walled in place and cannot physically leave for the rest of their life. And they spend all of their time in this enclosed, you know, architecturally enclosed, like it's not possible to leave space, being brought meals and whatever else they need by the outside.
I'm wondering if becoming an anchorite was a thing that people actively chose from time to time as pilgrims.
On the ninth. Mm-hmm.
Do you know how common it has been historically here in our history?
I would say definitely uncommon. There's examples of it in a number of times and places. It wasn't super, super like specific or rare. Like this wasn't a practice that was, you know, in one particular country or place. At the height of this practice, which would have been the 13th century, there were 200 anchorites in England. Okay. So not, you know, thousands, but also not two.
Yeah. Enough that a abbot or abbess would, whoever is responsible for that particular space, would have the knowledge of how to put someone through the initiation to get to that long term.
And the initiation involves having the rites of the dead said for the anchorite as they go into place. It is a living burial.
This tracks very much for what we were saying earlier about this being another layer of grieving for Harrow.
Mm-hmm.
Because had her parents received death rites prior to this?
Almost certainly not.
So this is like a very both personal and political pivot for Harrow.
It is probably the closest she's ever going to get to being able to acknowledge that her parents are dead.
Yeah. Where do you think she's storing them?
I think it says that they're basically in an antechamber to Alecto's tomb.
Okay, that's what I thought too.
Which serves the double purpose of preventing tampering.
Yes. Yeah. And we talked about decomposition earlier, but if we're looking at a less temperature controlled environment, there's definitely going to be a chance that they're just going to turn into little ice cubes.
That's true. Although I think there has to be some kind of temperature control if the house isn't like, wait, are they going to die?
True. True. Though, mind you, if the house knows that these different spaces in their institution can be controlled by climate, you're like, it's fine. And they can just be like, okay, so you think it's good. And also we're going to turn the heat down a whole bunch.
Yeah, for sure. Crux isn't actually paying to heat that space.
Yeah. And then we return to the question of, so what exactly is the ambient temperature in Drearbrough?
Yeah. Because we hear them putting on wool coats, but we don't hear them putting on full face protection. And, you know, like, it seems like it's cold. I mean, it's clearly very, very cold, but
they're not even wearing hats.
They're not described as wearing hats.
No mention of hats.
We get another kind of horrifying moment of telegraphing from Harrow. As Harrow is addressing the populace, she assures them, "You are my beloved house. Rest assured that wherever I go, my heart is interred here." Which on first reading just seemed like a weird kind of goth kid thing to say. But she is in love with the corpse.
Yeah. Ice Cube Barbie. It took me a long time to get that in my head, Harrow's relationship to the corpse, because to me it's not obvious, but the ways in which she interacts with it are distinctly different from literally every other relationship she has. And I think I'm still processing and internalizing that. And I think I will still continue to see more of those flags of her relationship to Alecto emerge as we go through. Because yeah, it's not her parents she's talking about. It's not the people she's talking about. As we go through each chapter, you know, we are discovering just how many little hints and flags at the future Mira's leaving for us. And this maybe is one of the most gut-wrenching so far. "Do you want," Gideon whispered huskily, "my hanky? I want to watch you die." "Maybe not, Jesmus," she said with deep satisfaction. "Maybe, but you sure as hell won't do it here." And it turns out maybe Harrow doesn't actually want to watch Gideon die.
Yeah. Nun Pod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Kaylee and edited by Han Kaylee. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art is by Claire Beans. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's NUNPOD nunpod.com or get our attention online using the hashtag #NunPod. Thanks for listening.